morning, this last day of August. My name is Michael McCusker. Today's program is about transdegenerative ignominy. An enormous population shift has occurred in the USA, the tectonics of which substantiate the theory that capitalism eats its own by shoving aside multitudes of working class proletariats in favor of the zillionaire few. In nearly every city and probably most towns and villages across the USA, millions of average American citizens are being ejected from their homes in favor of more affluent citizens, many of whom have profited from the cybernetic boom that is transforming human civilization quicker than climate change. The result is that millions of Americans are unable to find affordable housing. America's major refugee problem is with its own citizens labeled as homeless. Once valued and respected members of their communities are now regarded as homeless riffraff, with their citizenship essentially stripped away in practice, if not title. The causes of this massive displacement and dispossession, as well as disruption, are mottled. Blatant greed and unscrupulous home foreclosures generated by the odious financial collapse foremost among them. The current U.S. Treasurer is a major villain. And by corrupt and greed-stoked financial and political policies that have infested the nation like an Ebola plague. The insidious profiteering from this seismic change has been an exuberant lever that propels it, caustically pricing lower class levels out of home and hearth and virtually all safeguards and essential securities of citizenship that might have availed the dispossessed. The impetuous gentrification that swept upon Oregon coast like a tsunami has been a boon to the real estate industry, but it has inflicted homelessness and associated poverty upon displaced working families and individuals who were once the backbone of local coastal communities, but are now treated as vagrants and criminals simply because they were not unable to keep up with inflated housing and rental costs. The precipitous rise in property values might be the core definition of Oregon's so-called renaissance, which local chambers of commerce and realtors extol as prosperity growth. But the desperate grail of millions of Americans is affordable housing and adequate paying jobs, each of which are rapidly disappearing as the country's laws are radically readjusted to favor the possession of wealth and finance. Plutocracy subsumes democracy and the well-being of ordinary citizens. Inequality of wealth not only breeds general impoverishment and cultural dissolution, it displaces equality of liberty and justice. Constitutional guarantees of political and legal equality swiftly erode when the possession of wealth is considered more than equal. Inequality reckons people's worth by the contents of their wallets rather than their hearts and minds. Add to the mix Inquisitioner General Donald Trump's disfiguring of democratic society into a gulag of imprisoned immigrants and refugees in private for-profit prisons that have been rejuvenated in reversal of Barack Obama's attempt to disenfranchise them as the Nazi Gestapo horror chambers they are, which raises the specter of wholesale imprisonment of American citizens opposed to Trump's insurgent coup d'etat of government. The private prison industry's rapid expansion imitates the ugly precedent of internment of Japanese Americans 75 years ago, when Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066 in 1942 during World War II. Two-thirds of the Japanese incarcerated were American citizens. So now, I would like to read Homelessness is Not a Choice by Lee Miller, who is a displaced Astorian. The following incidents occurred at the Transitions Project Day Center, the Hanson and Columbia homeless shelters, and are the basis of a grievance I am filing against TPI, which is Transitions Project. My name is Leslie Miller, but I am also client 832784. I am presently lodged at the Columbia Shelter. There is no clear difference between being judged simply tardy by whoever is assigned to receive returning clients at a shelter, according to the indefinite and unpublished rules of TPI, or being deemed totally absent. Elementary schools perceive the difference, yet some TPI staff seem to apply these terms indiscriminately, often in a most egregious and captious regimen. Forcing a poverty-stricken, powerless, homeless senior citizen with disabilities back onto the street and depriving that person of services for a period of exclusion time is inconsistent with the mission to help the disadvantaged move from homelessness to housing. In fact, it is a real setback to one who is trying to save rent money for future use, find permanent housing, and has medical arrangements made in advance. One needs a solid base from which to operate, and this odious business practice only serves to jerk the rug out from under one's feet. Not only does the interpretation of unwritten and unpublished rules differ from shelter to shelter, but it appears from staff person to staff person, and acts all too often according to malicious whim. This calumny turns a would-be shelter into an internment camp. Staff should be rewarded for acting as caregivers and punished for acting like prison guards. The lack of specific, consistent, and published rules lends itself toward the arrogation of power by a few staff persons in the TPI program. Participants are not considered as fellow human beings. They are herded like farm animals from before the crack of dawn by a few staff who abuse their authority. At both the Hanson and the Columbia shelters, clients are rudely awakened at 5:30 a.m., 2.5 hours before any regular business is open, and forced out onto the street. On weekends, this gap of inopportunity lasts till about 9 or 10 a.m. At least at the Hanson shelter, clients are allowed to stay in the awake room, although not to take to their beds. Neither the hours, expulsions, nor the restrictions make any sense in the real world. Only changes in policy in both application and culture can improve conditions throughout the TPI program. Guard inmate roles between staff and clients must be eliminated. One person was excluded from the Columbia shelter recently and denied all TPI services for 7 days, allegedly because he had been written up for 5 offenses during 1 calendar month by staff. However, it is not clear how many write-ups were for simply being tardy after curfew, or how many were for not taking to his bed for a 24-hour period. Whichever, the act of exclusion is a setback in the struggle for one's self-sufficiency. Excluding a client is too often used as a hammer by staff to force a client to comply with rules that are not spelled out. The staff person waits for a mistake, then pounces like a predator to write up the client. This breaks the transition project's guideline that staff will first try to mitigate with a client before writing the person up. This also interferes with the project's mission to assist clients in the transition from homelessness to housing. This pattern of exclusion explains the dismal housing placement rate with the program. Only about 10% of the clients who enter the program are placed in permanent affordable housing. Most are excluded even before they are assigned a case manager. This might change if TPI were paid not by the head for each client that enters the program, rather for only those who are placed into housing. Exclusions would become costly and to be avoided. I was excluded from the Hanson shelter for 7 days because it was insinuated that I arrived late twice during a consecutive 30-day period. No one tried to talk to me about it before I was written up, so I was not given an opportunity to explain my side of the story. Why is it 5 infractions at the Columbia shelter during the calendar month and only 2 during a 30-day consecutive period at the Hanson shelter in order to be excluded? According to a larger rule, a staff person is supposed to discuss a problem with a participant and try to mitigate before committing it into a write-up. My colleague, who has been excluded for a week, is in for a rude awakening. He will find himself deprived of all TPI services during the time of his exclusion, including another bed, as I was. We were both told to check into the day office for an alternative bed, which was denied. Not only was I barred from TPI services, but other shelters in the Portland area are ill-equipped to accommodate my medical needs in regard to my BiPAP machine, which is prescribed for severe obstructive and central sleep apnea. It requires a floor-level bed near an electrical outlet and needs to operate at the same level as the mattress. I had to pay several hundred dollars for motel fees in order to meet these needs during my one-week exclusion. So much for saving any rent money during the month of July. I was not able to haul my belongings on TriMet buses or light rail and had to leave several hundred dollars worth of personal property and documents at the shelter while I was gone. These items were seized and disposed of. I was forced to postpone my eye surgery, which had been arranged for that month. I have been set back so far that I may never catch up, thanks to the vagary of the rules and the callousness of certain TPI personnel. Some seem way too eager to trespass someone in writing before working out a problem in person. On Friday, August 11th, I left Oregon City on a TriMet bus at 8 p.m. in order to connect with the MAX train at the Park Avenue platform, then to catch a bus on Martin Luther King Boulevard, which stops near the Columbia shelter. I called ahead to the shelter several times to let them know I was in transit and might be late, but no one answered the phone, and the voicemail box was not set up. If someone had answered, the receptionist would have waved me into the shelter without a hassle. I arrived at the shelter after 10 p.m. I explained that I did not anticipate it would take nearly 2.5 hours of travel time to arrive and requested the receptionist excuse my tardiness. She said I had to talk to people at another desk instead of accepting my reason for coming in late and making a written report to be held against me later. This is precisely the kind of foolishness that resulted in my exclusion at the Hanson shelter. I had called there on the two other earlier occasions and for the same reason, caught in transit through no fault of my own. This is unacceptable by any rationale. Too often I have heard that rules are rules and that if I don't like them, I can decide to leave the program. This is non sequitur. It does not follow that a shelter bent on helping some poor wretch find housing should shove homelessness in his face as an alternative. I think there are some important and humane actions for Transition Project to take at its shelters. Make punishments fair and flexible and make rewards considerable and expected. Keep track of staff who lurk in seclusion to wait for a client to make a mistake, then without discussion pounce like a predator with a write-up. Either suspend or dismiss staff persons who act this way and limit the total number of write-ups a staff person may make. Have all staff persons wear a large legible tag with their full name on it at all times. The single name thing is supposedly to safeguard anonymity, but it mostly insulates them from responsibility for their arrogance and disrespect for clients. They would be less likely to misconstrue a client's actions if they were to be held accountable. Take transportation schedules into consideration when opening and closing all facilities. Also take surrounding business hours into consideration. Do not force seniors and people with disabilities out of the shelter. Hire extra staff to keep the shelter open for them. Let them rest. Writing up a client without trying to mitigate should be grounds for dismissal. Let clients have access to the working water toilet at the Columbia shelter. Allowing only staff to use it is showing extreme favoritism. Double the number of porta-potties and have them serviced every other day. Make the rules identical in all of the shelters and publish them for both clients and staff. Do not refer to clients by their bed number. Learn their names. Put card readers on doors so that clients may use their ID cards to access and egress the facilities as they wish. Staff would not have to guard the doors to do head counts to have a record of when a client comes and goes or is present at any time. Do not use staff to guard the doors. Compensate for personal property seized and disposed of. I saw thousands of dollars worth of personal property thrown into the dumpster at the Hanson shelter. Making a person sign an agreement that will result in the loss of personal property not only is theft, but it is unconstitutional. Stop this disturbing and devastating practice. Do not make general wake-up calls. Only wake a person if requested. Stop making so many loud announcements. Excuse tardy arrivals whenever there is a good reason for them. Expunge unfair write-ups. In my humble opinion, not having an address and a place to call home is the first step in the loss of personhood in the United States. Homelessness is not generally a matter of choice, nor is it a choice to be dirty. Even a pork scene does not like being confined in its own filth and will seek clean mud to wallow in, sunshine to dry off, shade to rest in, and clean flowing water to bathe in. Humans also prefer to be clean if given the opportunity. One may lose a home either from bad luck or poor choice. Poor choices can be made through ignorance. No one should be shamed for poverty or bad luck. And that was Homelessness is Not a Choice by Lee Miller, who is a former resident of Astoria who has been a casualty of its gentrification. And now, Perverse Prisons for Profit by Dr. Robert Brake. The Northwest Detention Center, conveniently tucked into the tidelands near Tacoma, Washington, is a for-profit immigration prison among 250 detention facilities in the United States. As of mid-August, more than 30 Hispanic residents on the Long Beach Peninsula have been detained and incarcerated at that facility. Separated from families, those victims, yes, victims, receive no right to attorney or rehabilitation and endure poor medical treatment and poor nutrition. Since the Trump inauguration, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has escalated the war, and that's in quotes, on undocumented immigrants, encouraging private prison operators like the GEO Group, Core Civic, and Management Training Corporation to incarcerate more Hispanics and others who come to America for opportunity, employment, and freedom from oppression. I believe the United States is experiencing a major human tragedy. We have more people in jail than any other country on earth, including communist China, an authoritarian nation four times our size. With less than 5% of the world's population, we incarcerate about a quarter of its prisoners, some 2.2 million people. Consider these facts about prisons in America. We have 1,719 state prisons, 102 federal prisons, 942 juvenile detention centers, 3,283 local jails, 79 Indian County jails, several military prisons, plus those 250 immigrant detention centers. More than enough, wouldn't you say? The private prison industry is a formidable one, generating billions of dollars in revenue each year and providing significant amounts to politicians. For example, the GEO Group and Core Civic donated $250,000 to support the Trump inaugural festivities. Last December, a government panel recommended that the Department of Homeland Security, whose second largest agency is ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, continue with its use of private immigration detention facilities, saying such prisons were the only realistic way to handle the volatile flows, that's a quote, at the border. This, despite the fact that illegal entry along our borders has diminished significantly in recent years. David C. Fathi, director of the American Civil Liberties National Prison Project, claims that putting people into for-profit prisons is, quote, a recipe for abuse and neglect. The new Trump Sessions so-called Justice Department has issued a directive that seems to foreshadow the worrisome possibility that the United States is headed for a new federal prison boom. And that is truly worrisome to me. No one, in my view, should be allowed to profit from putting more people behind bars, whether they are inmates in jail or immigrants held in detention centers. Indeed, I believe that private prisons should not be allowed to exist at all. The current prison system in the United States has disproportionately harmed black and brown minorities, and well-documented horror stories from for-profit prisons are plentiful. Senator Bernie Sanders is a strong opponent of for-profit prisons and argues that it's wrong to profit from the imprisonment of human beings and the suffering of their friends and families. It's time to end this morally repugnant practice, and along with it, the era of mass incarceration. And Sanders is in good company on that score. Over 2,000 years ago, Roman rhetorician Cicero maintained that justice consists of doing no one injury, decency in giving no one offense. And that was Cicero. Clergyman and author Marty Duran says, we do need to seriously explore dismantling the prison industrial complex in which people are jailed so others may profit. And that was Marty Duran. Of course, some prisoners deserve incarceration, having committed serious offenses against people and property. But in the main, I subscribe to the conclusion articulated by Howard Zinn, maverick historian and author of A People's History of the United States. Quote, the prisons in the United States have long been an extreme reflection of the American system itself. The stark life differences between rich and poor, the racism, the use of victims against one another, the lack of resources of the underclass to speak out, the endless reforms that changed little. And that was Howard Zinn. Russian 19th century novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky once said, the degree of civilization in a society can be judged by entering its prisons. I wholeheartedly agree. And that was Perverse Prisons for Profit by Dr. Robert Brake, who is a retired educator and lives in Ocean Park, Washington. And he writes commentary for the Chinook Observer and regularly provides this program with his insights. And now, something I wrote for Labor Day, Union Dues. Labor Day is the second bookend of the silly season, the first being Memorial Day. Neither holiday means much anymore, although the first one will probably be gussied up to absolve and perpetuate harvests of war dead. Labor Day continues to decay because workers who produce the GNP are consistently undervalued, which originally forced them to unionize. Although grievously weakened and suffering tremendous losses of political power as a result of savage union busting and massive layoffs begun during the Ronald Reagan years, claims that the labor movement is dead are exaggerated, and it might actually be at a cusp of revival because, as the Oracle manifests, unions are bad, but without them it's worse. That perception is all too apparent when tens of thousands of workers lose their jobs and pensions to massive endemic corporate and political corruption. Stark discrepancies in wages and benefits between management and labor is obscene, and the people who do have jobs are required to produce more for less pay with little or no job security or semblance of union representation. Many who work for a living think the union is just another bureaucracy that filches money from their paychecks. Most union members seldom attend meetings, union meetings, or participate in decisions that affect them on the job. Yet the union is an opportunity for working people to have a measure of power against the iron fist of managerial power and provides the strength and potency for them to determine their working lives. The bottom line of unions is representing the rank and file. They pay dues to be adequately and fairly represented, whether they are active or a bunch of deadheads grousing about union dues extracted from their paychecks. And regardless if only a minority participate in elections, attend meetings, and act active, a union's job is to represent them all, which also happens to be the mandate of representative constitutional government. The American labor movement seems to be coming undone. The country is in a despotic upheaval of severe decline of the personal and political rights of working people. Union busting has decimated many of the country's largest and formerly strongest unions. Labor law has failed to protect workers, and government acts as a tool for the company. The bizarre consequence of a desperate backlash against the reigning status quo elected a swinishly corrupt and misanthropic narcissist past president, who is contemptuously demolishing the remnants of labor rights as well as the roots of democracy, turning the nation into a nihilistic Darwinian swamp of atavistic savagery. Democracy is always in flux between those who wish to protect and enlarge it and those who wish to reduce and confine it. Perhaps most people are vague or do not particularly respond to what our ancestors considered necessary for maintaining personal and political liberty, but erosions of them will ultimately ruin their lives. This nation and its people are in a period of severe decline of its most essential rights and liberties, and it is especially imperative for people who work for a living to understand what is at stake on the job and in the democracy at large. And I end today's program by paying homage to a beat-up old tuna fish boat named Meteor, which capsized and sank in the Columbia River Bar 45 years ago on August 29, 1972, almost straight across the river from where the Betty M. ran aground a few years later. Four of us who were aboard when Meteor went down, we all survived, rescued by other vessels that risked harm to save us. And virtually at the same time as Meteor's death, my friend Rick Sanders, a wrestler from Oregon who won a silver medal at the 1972 Munich Olympics, was killed in an auto accident in Yugoslavia on his way to Greece just afterward. Some of you might remember that was also the same Olympics in which several Israeli Olympians were murdered by a Palestinian group of assassins that called itself Black Friday. Many years later, I learned from another wrestler, the late Mark Davis, an historian born and bred, that a wrestling move was named after Rick, which Davis said was a last resort sort of move that he borrowed from the Sanders legacy to win a match in high school. This has been Michael McCusker. Happy Labor Day and back to school week. And as you sympathize with the victims of Hurricane Harvey, prepare for the great Cascadia earthquake and tsunami. Thank you.